This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
All right, welcome everybody to episode 4 of Cinematica Animalia Season 2, the podcast where we take a movie, creature, monster, and break them down, look at how they might work in the real world when considering their ecology and physiology. Today, we are looking at the ecology of the world of How to Train Your Dragon. Last week, we looked at the physiology of some of the various dragons. In the trilogy. But before we get into that, my name is Sam Perrin. I run and write at ecologyforthemasses.com. I'm also a PhD student at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. With me today is Adam Hakis, my co-host from the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, and fellow writer at Ecology for the Masses, and our veterinary friend.
Do you hot kiss your mother with that mouth?
I hot kiss your mother with this mouth. Hey, classic comedy. No, I've never met her before. I'm sure she's a lovely woman.
Of course, look at me.
And also my second co-host, Dave. Davey boy, old Davey Jones, who is a vet operating somewhere, presumably in Canada.
Allegedly,
yeah. Yes, we haven't confirmed this yet. Yeah, so... Yeah, how's it going, guys?
Yeah, good.
What have we got to talk about now? Oh, yeah, okay, so as we mentioned briefly last week, I've recently got red rump parrots that are managing to fly around at the moment. One of them completely fucked up his flight feathers upon exit from his tiny box that he was transported home in. But regardless, they are both absolutely terrified of my stepkid, who keeps running around excited, not realizing that they see him as a predator, and are shit scared of him.
Do you have names for them yet?
Yeah, he named them Thomas and Lisa.
Oh, boring. That's nice.
Yeah, it's very conservative, considering normally his names are real weird.
Should have named him also, Derp and Derpy.
You're in Norway. You're in the area of great, like, Viking names for parrots.
Well, I wanted, like
Ragnar.
I wanted like one really like overly Norwegian name, like Siri or like Anders or something like that, and then one like overly bogan Aussie name, like Davo or
Gary
or Gaz, yeah, something like that. Like I just wanted Gaz and Anders or something like that. Yeah.
Oh, what were the names of Odin's ravens?
Left and right. Truth and knowledge, I think.
Moogly.
They had really cool names. No, it's like Mungi Ugin and... or Huggin.
They translate to truth and knowledge, don't they?
Mergen and Durgen. Oh, hello. Yeah, sorry, so... Oh, that's a nice little trill.
Huggin and Munnin.
There you go, Huggin and Muggin. the affectionate street thief. He hugs and he mugs.
Should have called him Huggin and Kissin.
Oh, hello, we're getting some nice bird song. That'll be the backdrop to many of the podcasts.
Yes, they were pretty quiet last week. This week, not so much.
They're not shutting up right now.
Tell me what thy lordly name is on the nice Plutonian shore.
Quoth the raven.
Eat my shorts.
Bart, stop it.
Anyway, what we're going to do today is, like I said, we took you through the basis of the How to Train Your Dragon trilogy last week and told you what we thought of the films. This week what I'm going to do is go through kind of the history, not of dragons in cinema. We're going to touch on that later in the season when we look at Game of Thrones. But we're going to go through the history of Vikings. As Hiccup, the main character of these films, town is very much a Viking town. Based, we're assuming, either somewhere in northern Scandinavia, based on the island nature. If it is on, you know, planet Earth. Could be, like I said, there's references made to it being a flat Earth sort of thing, so... Who knows? But it could also look a lot like northern Canada, where you've got a lot of archipelagos, islands flying away from each other, that sort of thing. In any case, we're going to go through the history of Vikings in film. Then Adam and I are going to look at some different aspects of the ecology of these dragons that we see throughout the trilogy. And then we'll end with a fun little versus that Adam has plotted out for us. Yeah.
That's what I do.
So, in any case, Vikings. I live in Norway, as you may have figured out at various points in this podcast, and I've heard a lot of different things about the Vikings here, everything from them being, you know, this savage race of warriors and pillagers to some of the forerunners of gender equality in the seafaring industry.
Can they be both?
They can be both, yes, absolutely. There's some really interesting research being done at the moment, because traditionally when they found like a Viking burial mound or that sort of thing, or a Viking burial ship, they would assume it was kind of a chieftain if it was a male, and assume it was like, you know, a bride or a wisdom or old wise woman if it was a female. But there's some research that's been going on the last few years which has said, actually, if you look at these two and don't take gender into it at all, you would just assume that they're both chieftains. Like, people have just been making the assumption that they weren't chieftains because they thought of them as women. But there's been a lot of evidence uncovered recently that some of these warriors were actually women. In any case, I don't want to get too much into that. Vikings kind of dropped out of any form of like public interest for a huge period of time, from the end of the Viking Age until Victorian England. They weren't that interesting. They didn't figure in plays, literature, stories, anything like that. But the Victorian, the English loved a bit of bloody romance and seafaring, fighting, that sort of shit. They love the romanticization of the violence in the crazy wild North Seas and all that sort of shit. So that's when, yeah, the Vikings really came back into popular culture at the time. That's around when they think that the horns on the helmet got attributed to them as well.
Right.
That sort of stuff. Mm. But then there's their first appearance in film is supposedly The Viking Bride in 1907, which is just a crappy little short film. But then this is actually really interesting, and I have to attribute the Den of Geeks article on why cinema is so obsessed with Vikings for a lot of this info. The first,
it's hot Scandinavian women. That's why.
Fair enough. Yeah. No, but the first feature to be shot in Technicolor with a full soundtrack was actually called The Viking. It was an account of Leif Erikson and his life and all that sort of shit.
Cool.
And then
actually made it to North America, unlike Christopher Columbus. Mm-hmm. Fucking idiot.
Yes, he knew where he was going. Yeah. Yep. There's a fairly well-known...
Christopher Columbus knew where he was going. He was going straight to hell, but...
Yes. Probably rotting there right now.
In the Caribbean.
No, but then there's The Vikings, which cropped up in 1958. Kirk Douglas, Tony Curtis, big names for the time.
Hmm.
Roger Corman. I don't know if you guys have heard of Roger Corman, like this schlocky 70s, 80s horror director. I think he did the Fantastic Four movie that never got released.
That sounds right. Ugh.
Yeah, anyway, he in 1957 had a movie called Viking Women and the Sea Serpent, which was
this a porn?
It was getting a little on that side of things. The Den of Geek describes it as a bunch of scantily clad bee girls in a rickety homemade longboat against a dodgy toy snake.
Huh.
Classic cinema. Huh. Yeah. Anyway, fast forward a bit, you've got The Norseman in 1978, Conan the Destroyer in 1984.
Such a good film.
Berserker in 1987. What else? Valhalla Rising, which is by Nicholas Winding Refn, who you guys might know from Drive, and...
It is such a good film.
Yeah, well, I don't think it is, but whatever, that's fine, yeah. I don't like Drive. It's not enough driving.
No, I meant Drive is good, but Valhalla Rising is what I meant.
Oh, Valhalla Rising. Oh, okay, fair enough. I have not seen that. And Adam and I were talking about the film. No, actually, we decided that wasn't Vikings, didn't we? Yeah.
Which one?
King Arthur.
King Arthur, 2004.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Saxons.
But that brings us up around about now to the time of... and of course they feature a little bit in the first Marvel 4 movie. Very briefly. Yeah.
They're all... Netflix's Last Kingdom is a huge success, and it's just all Viking. It's great.
Or the History Channel's Vikings from 2012.
Yeah, and there's also... there's another one that... Kingdom of... No, not Kingdom of Heaven. Forbidden Kingdom or some shit like that? I don't know.
That's something else, I think.
But you know the one I'm talking about?
Forbidden Kingdom is famously the Far East. It's usually China.
I've been watching a lot of Last Kingdom, so...
Last Kingdom, that's the one.
That's the...
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and that that brings us up to speed, pretty much, on the history of Vikings in cinema. Yeah.
In ships of their own making, sleek and wind-fast, Viking women set out to combat the unknown terrors of uncharted seas. In spite of the fables told of the gigantic, the gargantuan, the fearsome great sea serpent.
So, Adam, should we get stuck into to the ecology then?
I mean, if we have to.
Yeah, yes. So we're going to touch on...
proper order to go on this? Speciation first, maybe?
Yeah, we're going to touch on speciation first, how some of these different dragons have evolved. Then look at the sustainability of the population, which is actually very, very well touched on in the third film.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, they get right into that, yeah.
Yeah, it might not have been clear from last week's episode, but I have not seen this movie, and I don't think Dave has either, the third one. Uh-huh. But
I'm the only one who's seen it.
At least broad strokes, I felt there was absolutely no need to see it, because the entire movie was given away in the trailer, and I refuse to see it now.
No, it's still really good fun. It's still a good movie, and you should still go and see it. I don't think it's as good as the other two, but it's just a solid end to the trilogy. But anyway, yeah, to start off with, there's too many fucking different kinds of dragon in these films.
Yeah.
It's there's no I mean theoretically you could have this broad of species divergence within a clade, within a group of organisms. You see it in things like fish have an incredibly diverse group, and also insects, which are incredibly varied in form and function. But for this group of organisms to be living where they are on what seems to be an island, probably smaller than Iceland, which is not an enormous island, they have way too much of diversification. The population numbers are too high.
Yeah.
And unless they are functionally the same species, I mean, they would have to be functionally different species and have different niches within the environment to be able to sustain themselves.
Do you say niche?
Yes.
He says...
Oh my god! Sorry, mind blown here. What do you say, Dave?
Niche,
okay, good.
I switch back and forth because sometimes it sounds ridiculous saying niche out loud, but then we had a whole discussion with this in our paper group yesterday where people were saying niche and niche, and it varies for me.
Okay, fair enough.
You know this about me. I don't really go straight.
Okay, fair enough, yes. But we know you don't go straight, yeah. No, but yeah, I mean, there could be this amount of differentiation, like you said, Adam. I mean, you see it in birds. And it's almost exactly the same here. You see large birds that don't... that can't fly, as you have large dragons that can't fly and this sort of thing. You have... Dragons that don't exist. Yeah, exactly. Fair enough. Good point. You have, completely different morphs, different looking things, but they're all the same size. And they all look like they're inhabiting roughly the same sort of area, the same sort of environmental niche. I mean,
and they're eating the exact same food resource, fish.
Exactly. I mean,
yeah.
Competitive exclusion is an ecological theory which basically says that if you have two species in the same area which are exploiting the exact same resources, one of them will be forced out. And in these, you have so many species just living in the same part. So it just
doesn't
work.
You also have what's called character displacement, where some part of their morphology starts to change. And that's part of the famous example with Darwin and his finches. He noticed that they had different sized beaks, and they would eat different things. And that's how you can have so many different species of this, basically the same type of bird, living in the same area. Another really good example of that is anoles in tropical islands, or even just in the tropics, basically, where you can have one tree, and on that tree you have four or five different species of this same kind of lizard, because the big ones live on the top, The really small ones live on the really small branches. You have kind of a medium-sized one that lives on the trunk exclusively, and others live exclusively on branches.
Yeah.
And because they eat different things, they live in different parts of that same environment. They can exist in that same area, but these dragons are all the same size. They're eating the exact same thing. It wouldn't work.
Yeah. If some of them were a lot smaller, it could potentially work. There's this thing called, I think it's Allen's Rule, whereby as you get away from the tropics, you have much lower species richness. Now, this is way away from the tropics, so of course you're going to have very little species richness. But within the tropics, because there's so much productivity in so many smaller areas, you have tons of different species inhabiting the same area, but much smaller species as well, and they're exploiting different resources. As we've said, I think this is, there's too many species exploiting the same resources in the exact same area.
Yeah, one thing they would have to play into their behavioral ecology, which we'll touch on later, that I think is the only way this could work, is that they're not actually separate species, they're just different breeds.
Yes. Yeah.
Much like you have with dogs, where people might not realize dogs are one species. That's why you can have them breed. That's why any of the puppies they have can also breed, because they are the same species. They just look incredibly different.
Yeah.
But from what you were saying, Sam, the third movie directly contradicts this?
Well, there's just too much variation. What I think the third movie directly contradicts is, I think what's happened is, you're right, your solution is perfect, like, that they're different breeds. So I think what's happened is the Vikings have actually, at one point in the past, domesticated dragons, bred them for different purposes, and then they've gone wild again. It might be like this massive ongoing cycle. So at the end of the third film, they release the dragons back into the wild. And it'd be funny in five generations that humans have forgotten that they had once again domesticated dragons. And the war starts up again. Maybe this cycle has just been ongoing for the last like two millennia. So they've domesticated dragons, bred them for different purposes so that they can coexist. But they've just forgotten about it because they've released them back into the wild. Ethics, animal ethics, has become a big part of their society. And then, you know, they've paid the price for it in one vicious cycle that just keeps going on for the entire lifespan of this world.
Yep, sounds about right.
Yeah. So maybe that's what's happening, yeah. But then, like I said, and I think we can get into this more at the end, but in the second film even, the world where his mum's living, they're all just living in the same, in one big area.
And there's even more of them in a smaller area, it seems like.
Yeah.
Right, with one central dragon that seems to have some form of kinship or connection to all of them.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in the last section when we talk about some of their behavior.
Yeah, that enormous size difference, even though you see a big size difference in dogs, you don't see one to that magnitude.
No.
The same species.
Yeah. I mean, that Dave, I think you made a note last week that alpha dragon, that's the alpha at the start of the second film, is like 2.5 times the size of a blue whale.
No, that was that's for the Game of Thrones episode where... For Balerion, the Black Dread, the biggest one to ever exist in that universe, that Aegon the Conqueror used to conquer all of Westeros, and other dragons.
But the alpha is bigger than that. The alpha is ridiculously big. I mean, we think that at the end, the Red Death is going to be like our biggest dragon, and the alpha comes along, and the alpha, we're far too enormous. We're the size of like multiple skyscrapers put together. We're a Cloverfield monster. We're too big.
Yeah, and that, like, the Cloverfield monster is like skinny and lanky. That is a big, bulky fucking thing in How to Train Your Dragon 2.
We would have to be, our metabolic rate and what we'd be consuming would be off the charts.
It would be eating other dragons.
It did, I think.
It would be eating everything. Yeah. It would be eating everything.
Yeah. Now, this is the next thing that we want to talk about. Like, even if theoretically you somehow have all of these dragons existing in harmony together, there doesn't seem to be too many other land animals there. So I'm assuming that they're all eating fish.
Or sheep.
But that's the thing.
Or
like,
Vikings.
There's a real negative to attacking the Vikings, though. Because, I mean, the Vikings fight back. And the Vikings are shown to be reasonably adept at capturing and killing them.
Right. In that case, you have what's called, at least for the ecology, of intra-guild predation. And that's when you have organisms that are on the same trophic level. So it's like if a predator, like a lion, is eating other lions. That's called intra-guild predation. They're feeding not only on the resource below them, but within their own trophic level.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And Adam, I'm thinking that it might be an effective method of population control, because if they're eating fish all the time, you're eventually going to get into a point where your prey species drops, right?
Right, but at least if their population density isn't too high and they happen to live in more of a kind of a higher latitude, more productive area, they're going to have higher fish populations.
Yeah, true. But I mean, I still think that with that many there, they're eventually going to get into population spikes of dragons, which are going to be followed by population crashes and then fish. And that's where intra-guild predation might start, where attacking the humans might start. Because it doesn't seem like the town's constantly under attack. It seems like it happens every now and then. So maybe...
It's enough of a threat for them to watch out for it at all times, but it's not happening every single day. Another thing with their populations getting that dense, another problem they're going to run into is disease. Because when you're in a very small area like that, you have a really high population density, and they're not going to be getting a lot of new genes in, so their genetic diversity is going to be pretty poor. So they're going to be very vulnerable to epidemics sweeping the populations, which is another thing that will keep their populations down in a cyclical fashion.
A lot of this depends on... Because we don't see a lot of the world. There's a lot of ocean out there. Mm-hmm. A lot of this depends on how much land there actually is. Because if there are land animals and that sort of thing, then you could potentially have enough resources whereby you've got dragons going between populations and all that sort of stuff. But if there's very little land out there and you have really isolated populations, they're going to really suffer from inbreeding depression. They're going to have population crashes all the time. In the third film, we were talking before about the land where the mother's hiding, where you've got tons of dragons in the same place.
Right.
They take that to the extreme in the third film. There's this land where all dragons apparently come from, and they're just thousands of them living in one place. And
is that another island or is it a continent?
It's this underground sea world thing. Fuck, I don't know. It's a bit iffy, but yeah, I think the inbreeding depression. Attacks on humans, inter-guild predation, along with I think that would keep the populations in check.
And diseases.
Yes, and disease, yeah. I think that would keep the populations in check. And so they, wouldn't just explode. And you do see in the third film, one of the big issues is, and I said this, as soon as the third film started, you see Burke is just crowded with fucking dragons. They're everywhere. Because presumably they're taking care of them, so disease gets cut out.
They're supplementing their food.
Yeah, they're supplementing their food. And it's a completely unsustainable population. And I was like, oh, this is really dumb, straight up. But that's that's the premise of the first half of the film, is that there's too many fucking dragons and they need to go and find somewhere else. So I was like, yeah, okay, good.
And with this limited gene pool, it kind of makes sense with a lot of these different organisms, a lot of these different dragons. I know they're supposed to kind of look weird for the purpose of being funny, but... The weird looking jaw of the monstrous nightmare, the big tail of the big jaw and small wings of the meatlug or the gronkles, that bony thick tail of the grump or the hot burp. These guys are obviously all suffering from an enormous amount of genetic defects.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Except for maybe the night fury, because it has such a small population anyway.
Yeah.
They're not really inbreeding as much.
And it should be noted that if anybody has been watching these films and has been saying, I really want a dragon. You don't want a dragon, you want a cat.
Yeah.
All right, like...
And you don't want a cat, you want a dog.
Yeah.
Toothless is very much a cat, though, in terms of the way he goes around. He grooms himself repeatedly through the film, the sort of jumping and bouncing and playing with anything in the path, even the chasing the laser pointer. So for anyone who's I wish that these existed in real life, they are...
He likes playing fetch, and he does have a lot more loyalty to his owner than a cat does.
Cats fetch, hey.
Cats,
not
that's my one use of the C bomb in this episode. the last thing that we really wanted to touch on is the behavioral ecology, the way they form these hierarchies between species.
Yeah, they have some kind of class system going within them, which you do have plenty of organisms in nature, including humans, that have this kind of caste-like society based off of who's the strongest individual, which one is in charge. Like silverback gorillas, there are a lot of different organisms where there's a dominant female that kind of rules over the group.
Yeah.
There are plenty of cervids, like deer and elk, that have a dominant like buck with a harem of females around them. But for this to work, it implies there is some kind of class system working between species.
Yeah.
Which I could only think of an example with humans having a alpha hierarchy over their trained dogs. But besides that, I can't think of another one.
What you said in the first one is right. They have to be different breeds. But, I mean...
Yeah. But it doesn't work with their form and function.
Yeah, it switches so easily. Like, for instance, in the second film, Hiccup stares down and intimidates the massive big alpha, and he becomes the alpha of the pack. Like, that...
Toothless.
Toothless and Hiccup. I get them the wrong way around. One's a dragon, one's a boy. They're very easy to confuse. But in any case, yeah, the Toothless becomes the alpha, and he's still the alpha in the third film, despite the fact that there's much larger, more intimidating dragons in there.
Or in the second one, the villain brings an alpha himself, and all he does is yell at it, and all of a sudden it's like, uh-oh, you're my master now.
Now, it should be noted that alpha relationships within domesticated species are a little bit strange. So, for example, we used to think that, like, roaming packs of dogs had, like, a clear alpha that took care of, like, these street dogs.
Yeah.
But when we were looking at a lot of the animals that were sort of left to fend for themselves following, like, the end of the Cold War, we did end up seeing that they actually, their pack structure is so effed up because of what human beings have done via domestication, that the alpha shifts on a pretty regular basis. So, like, one day it'll be the Great Dane that's leading the pack, and you're like, yeah, that's what should be leading it, the really, really big dog. But the next day it's the Chihuahuas, it seems to be, like...
Okay.
So your idea of domestication could alter their structure of what they consider to be alpha enough that they could accept, like, smaller, weaker dragons, depending on sort of displays of dominance within the group.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. But for instance, in the second film, they're very much a wild population of dragons that Toothless becomes the alpha of.
Yeah.
Because his mother doesn't seem to have done anything to domesticate them whatsoever. Because it's just her living with a bunch of dragons.
Right, but I was saying more building into your theory that the dragons were domesticated
at
and
one
been
point,
going into cycles. Yeah.
But I think they've definitely gone wild again in a lot of these situations, in most of these situations.
Yeah, but I'm saying just because a population returns to a feral base doesn't mean that a domesticated species gets completely back to where it should be.
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, okay, that's a potential solution. Yeah.
And if we're going with the whole logic that they're kind of going these cycles of domestication and release domestication by the Vikings, then there would never have enough time to completely rewild themselves 100%.
Yeah, true. Oh, I don't know. Like, how long does a cycle last? If it's 200 years, I mean, how long did it take to create some of these breeds of dogs, Dave?
A very long time in terms of, like, thousands of years.
Yeah, see, that's the issue.
Well, I mean hundreds, but, like, in terms of original dog domestication, their record is kind of weird, and it does take a long time. However, they just have had a researcher out of Russia. She's the one who's made those domesticated foxes. Who did some, frankly, really brutal experiments to sort of show how you could make domesticated foxes and what the period of time it takes to create domestication is. And I mean, she managed to do it in a period of like 10 or 20 years.
Okay,
fair enough, yeah. All right, well, Adam, I think that's all we wanted to touch on this time, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, we touched briefly on the prey sustainability, but yeah. Unless there's some kind of niche differentiation or character displacement, there's nothing going on that could work.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think the population cycles, like I said, keeping the population sustainable, I think that's interesting, and I think that could potentially work. But just the speciation and the behavior makes no sense.
Oh, the day you were chosen as Dragon Warrior was the worst day of my life. By far, nothing else came close. It was the worst, most painful, mind-destroying, horrible moment I have ever experienced.
All right, well, Adam, you got a fun versus for us.
Yeah, so Sam has brought up a few times, this is one of his favorite trilogies and movies, and it also is animated, so I'm thinking what happens is, in Kung Fu Panda, which is set in the mythology of China, despite it being a Chinese kind of folklore type deal and kind of a lot of their animals associated with that country, you never really see dragons. So I'm thinking that tigress, panda, crane, mantis, and
the Furious
monkey.
Five.
No, the Furious Five decide they need to bring in a dragon. So they travel to Burke and needed to wrangle the Night Fury to bring into their pantheon of great Chinese legendary beasts to fight with them.
Okay. Whew. So could they take down Toothless and capture him, is what you're saying?
I mean, we can, as with all of their physics-defying moves that they have in Kung Fu Panda, I think they could easily work it out. I mean, Mantis is like holding weapons that are 20 times his length and hundreds of times his mass.
Mm-hmm. You're breaking my suspension of disbelief.
Well, see, this is the
thing. Oh, the Mantis doing Kung Fu? I'm sorry.
So we're going with a Toothless that can fly, presumably.
Yep.
But a Toothless that spits... Well, if you listen to last week's episode, you'll know that Toothless is probably actually vomiting up flaming chunks of meat.
Which makes sense with the whole cat and a hairball thing.
Yeah. Which would splatter probably, and catch on fire, but not necessarily create enormous explosions.
And probably can't fly, but we'll give... Everybody gets one, so we'll let Toothless fly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like Crane's going to have a big role to play in this whole thing, because he's the only one that can fly.
And Mantis.
Can Mantis fly?
He never flies in the movies, but Mantis
can't
fly.
Crane is the only one that can fly in Kung Fu Panda.
But we're shown
literally
that Crane
fly.
Is capable
the
of
air like crazy.
But Crane is capable of holding up some of his fellows.
A lot of his fellows.
Yeah, we've
yeah.
Seen. He flew all the way back to the village with all of them in tow after Xiao Lao beat.
No, that's Iron Fist.
Yeah. Well. Ian McShane's character. Ian McShane,
regardless,
Kung Fu Panda.
The panther.
Yeah. No, the snow leopard. He's a snow leopard.
That's
yeah. He is.
Fuck. What's his name?
Xiao Long?
Where are you going? Where are you going with this? So Crane is going to have to try to fight Toothless in the sky. Is that where you're getting to?
He's going to have to bring him down.
I think what's going to end up happening is that you're going to have Kung Fu Panda figure out a way to kind of trick him using dumplings and food. You set them up. Get a giant wicker basket.
Wait, no,
with
not.
A little,
we're not talking
no,
about
just, even just a wicker basket. Toothless is so much like a cat. You put a wicker basket out there, he's just going to go sit in it. Then you put the lid on it, and he's done.
Okay, yeah. I want Toothless to win this, though.
I think Toothless is going to win this.
I think he would win it, especially if he has hiccups.
If we are trying to do a realistic world for Toothless, then we have to give those same principles to the Kung Fu creatures, which means that in a forest, a panda sitting next to a tiger, sitting next to a crane, sitting next to a mantis, that have nothing to do with each other, and are just kind of sitting there, are going to have this giant dragon descend and eat all of them.
Well, hang on. I thought that Poe wasn't involved.
Who's not involved?
He wasn't involved.
Oh, if Poe's involved, then Toothless is fucked. Because remember at the end of the second Kung Fu Panda, how like Poe learns to like take the fireballs and like spit them back at people?
Yeah.
Yeah, Toothless is fucked if Poe's there. Like, I think Toothless wins
He's
if Poe's not there.
He's a phlegm rocket.
Yeah.
Just hurl it back at him.
You're putting a lot of faith in Poe here, Sam. You do love him, but...
He's motivated by dumplings.
He's motivated by dumplings. He's just going to imagine the Toothless's head is a big old dumpling. Fuck, those birds are noisy right now.
They're birds. They're never quiet.
Yeah,
I'm amazed they were quiet last week.
Anyway, yeah, we need to have a rock, paper, scissors here. Do we think Poe is involved or isn't involved? Because if Poe's involved, then I think Toothless is fucked. But
if we're doing Toothless versus Kung Fu Panda, you kind of need to have the Kung Fu Panda.
Yeah,
well,
true.
Toothless versus the Furious Five.
Okay, Toothless versus the Furious Five, I feel like he can take Crane, and then he can just, like, eat Crane and rain down chunks of Crane coated with fireballs on the others.
I think Mantis would just be in comic relief, just being smashed by accident or something.
Yes, exactly. I think it'd be not so much of a kid's film anymore.
I think that a monkey would kind of see that Toothless is spitting up all these flame fireballs and retaliate by shitting in his hand and throwing it at him. That's not going to help.
Good too, yeah. No, I'm giving this one to Toothless.
Yeah, I think okay. so.
That's fair. Cool.
Next week we will be starting with the physiology of the mermaids. We don't have a specific mermaid in mind yet, but there's a couple of good films out there that we'll have a look at.
Examples including Little Mermaid and that terrible Pirates of the Caribbean film.
Yes, there are Cabin in the Woods. Say again.
Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah, they're not in Cabin in the Woods long enough though to do a whole thing on them.
They're in there enough to get a lot out of it.
There's this really bad schlocky movie from the noughties, I think, with Carla Cugino in it.
There's a show that just came out recently.
And isn't there? There's a mermaid show called Tidelands that's out right now as well.
Oh, no shit.
There must be another one, because there's... Let me look this up. There's one that just started here that looks so, so bad.
Here we go. Here's the synopsis for Tidelands. After an ex-con returns to her fishing village, a dead body leads her to uncover the secrets of the town and its half-siren, half-human residents. Yeah, I'll be honest, that sounds
That's
weird.
Tidelands?
That's Tidelands, yeah.
Yeah.
The one here is called Siren, and it looks bafflingly bad. Like, just like a WB-type Lifetime teenage actors that don't know how to act, and it's this woman playing a siren who could walk on land for whatever reason, but she's like, oh, I don't know how humans work, isn't this funny? Blah, blah, blah. It looks so bad.
So. Anyway, but we'll come back next week, and we'll be looking at the physiology of mermaids, but in the meantime, Adam... Bring us to the end of proceedings.
Yes, you can find Sam and I on Twitter. Sam is at SamParentNTNU. I'm at HasekAdam. You can find the podcast at C_Animalia. Visit our website, CinematicaAnimalia.com. You can email us with questions, comments, suggestions, or just, you know, tell us how good we are. Tell us about all that. I always love hearing it. Cinematica.Animalia@gmail.com. And if you want to check out any more of the strictly ecological stuff that Sam and I do, you can find us at ecologyforthemasses.com. If you have a sick pet and you're in Canada, maybe you can find Dave. I don't know. Apparently he's a vet. I don't believe it.
Just go to your vet. Please, people, go to your vet at a reasonable time frame.
And as we say at the end of every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Bye.